Sometime during the weekend, one of our nice devotees, during the question and answer session of our discussion, asked a question that inspired me to speak about this evening. A practical kind of question. And first we'll offer our respects to our founder Acharya Srila Prabhupada, who's guiding the members of ISKCON through his transcendental writings and teachings and wonderful example. The question that was raised was how to distinguish needs from wants. And it's particularly relevant because the teachings that we're following, the Srimad Bhagavatam, the principal scriptural source that's providing the guiding light of our lives, is a process. I'm going to educate you in a couple of words, terms from Sanskrit. Nivritti Marg. Nivritti Marg means progressively diminishing material involvement, specifically affinity for matter, trying to be the enjoyer of matter, progressively decreasing material affinity for matter kind of involvement, while on the other hand, increasing one's attachment for the supreme atmosphere, the internal potency of the Supreme Lord, like that. Disconnect and connect. So, bearing that in mind, that's the progressively we're moving in that direction. Those who are following these teachings will move in that direction. And it doesn't mean artificially just giving things up. It means affinity for being the enjoyer of those things. In other words, instead, like we have a nice temple, and look how gorgeously Kishore Kishori are decorated, and nice flower garlands and ornaments and so many nice things. Nice things are for Krishna. And we like to use nice things. We have a nice temple and keep it very clean and make very nice offerings. We offer them to Kishore Kishori. We offer them to Krishna. By that desire to please the Supreme, the affinity for being the enjoyer of matter slackens or diminishes. And that's our process. So as we're moving along in that process, how do we distinguish where our needs are? That without these set of things, I can't peacefully prosecute my devotional service. And different are those things that I think I need, or at least I want, whether I need them or not. So that was the question, and that's the topic we're going to discuss this evening. Now, the way that I responded over the weekend is a little, I'm just going to expand on it a little bit. And in order to expand on it a little bit, there's one other term, Sanskrit term, that I want to discuss, and that's ahankara, which Bhakti Siddhanta, Srila Prabhupada's spiritual master, has translated as the mundane egoistic principle. Making a distinction between there's a true self and there's a false sense of self, or a mundane egoistic principle. So this is a little dictionary definition. I just looked it up before coming down here. Ego, your consciousness of your own identity, or self, like who you are. That's ego. And there's a mundane egoistic sense of self, and there's a true or spiritual sense of self. So we can look inside and ask ourselves, who am I? Generally, people don't do that. They just go, 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 and never ask, who am I? Mode of passion runs their life without any reflection on who am I, what's the goal of life, where am I going, and all those very simple things, essential things. So to take a little closer look at what ahankara is, or false ego is, I'm going to take you, the next picture is, well, it's the cover of First Canto Bhagavatam, but this is a picture of the spiritual sky. In the vastness of the spiritual sky, there's unlimited numbers of Vaikuntha planets, or spiritual planets, chief and topmost of which is Goloka Vrindavan, shaped like a lotus, and the center of the lotus, there's Radha and Krishna. And of course, all of their associates and the river Jamuna and cows and peacocks and they're Krishna's friends and his mother and his father. The whole of Vrindavan is at the center, and then there is this lotus where the abodes of the residents of and the associates of Krishna reside also. And then down here is a cloud of material energy. And the cloud of the material energy has a name. The essential name is Pradhan. And Pradhan can be explained as the sum total of the material energy in its undifferentiated state. Undifferentiated state means the different elements that make it up are not separated out. Just like a big jumbled up warehouse, kind of. And within that area of the Pradhan, you see Mahavishnu. Mahavishnu is reclining, and he's lying on the causal ocean, Karana ocean. And from time to time, as he exhales, these universes, now here's the cloud, and here's the spiritual sky where Krishna is in the Krishna Loka, but now dark in that cloud area, there's Mahavishnu, a little closer up picture of him. And as he exhales, these little seeds, bijas of universes expand from his body into the field of the material energy. And the universes expand, and just like our material scientists say, they also will contract after some time. And when that happens, the elements go back to their Pradhan state, and the living entities are in a state of rest within the body of Mahavishnu. That's his inhalation. And then he holds his breath. And then he exhales again, and the universal seeds expand and enter into the field of the material energy. And there's details. I'm obviously not describing the details, but numberless, the Vedic picture tells us that there's numberless universes. There's finite, but there's so many you can't count them. That's how many. Too many to count. And the process, it's this cyclical process of creation, maintenance for some time, and withdrawal of the creation, is activated by Mahavishnu glancing. His senses are very powerful. We, when we have our worship of the deities in the morning, Mangal Arati, and then the curtains close, and the devotees dress the deities and bathe the deities, and we open the curtain, and we sing this nice song, Angani Yasya Sakalendriya Vritti Manti. Pashyanti. So the verse is saying, the form of the Supreme Lord, Mahavishnu or Krishna, is fully transcendental, such that any one of his senses, because he's unlimitedly powerful, any one of his senses can perform the activity of any of the other senses. We can't do that. We can't eat with our ears. But Krishna can eat with his ears. And he can eat with his eyes. Just see the offerings and he can eat them. And sometimes they're all gone and sometimes they're still there. Depends. At Govardhan Puja time, you just recently observed Govardhan Puja, offerings were made to Lord Hari and he ate everything. And then he said, I want more. And they brought him more and he ate everything. And he said, I want more. They didn't have any more because they emptied their storerooms and they didn't have a Kmart or a Supermart or something. They had what they had. It was all gone. So Lord Balaram suggested that they offer him a tulsi leaf and he was then satisfied. So sometimes, the point is, with his senses, he can do anything. So by his glancing, Mahavishnu glances over this cloud of the material energy. He just glances. But because his glance is very powerful, the living entities that are within his transcendental body are carried by the glance of Mahavishnu, along with the time energy. Time energy is one of Krishna's energies. And time is also very powerful. It moves things, if you haven't noticed. Besides the hands of the clock move, time brings things into being and it destroys things. Just wait a while and watch. Things are brought into being and things are destroyed. And the energy that's moving it is time energy. Tick, 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 tick. And things are coming into being and things are being destroyed. So by his glance, the time energy and the living entities are carried into the field of the material energy. And there's a person that carries the glance, and his name is Shambhu. And because I've been studying Sri Brahma Samhita, I'm going to share with you what it says about, you know, here's this word, ahankara. Shambhu embodies or enshrines the mundane egoistic principle. So when the glance, Shambhu, contacts the field of the material energy, it becomes energized by the living entities and by the time energy of the Supreme Lord. So I'm describing for you the process of creation as the Vedic wisdom teaches it. And this is a particular verse which says, the function of Shambhu, the glance, in relation to the living entities, is that this universe enshrining the mundane egoistic principle has originated from Shambhu. He's like the father, and the material energy is the mother. And the combination of the two makes procreation. The mother and the father, the living entities are carried by Shambhu and they're impregnated within the material energy, and even before the living entities do anything, they don't have forms, they're not like moving around, they're infused with the mundane egoistic principle. Before we even do anything, here's Bhaktisiddhanta's purport. Shambhu fully enshrines the mundane egoistic principle, the innumerable jivas, the living entities, as spiritual particles emanating from Mahavishnu in the form of pencils of rays of effulgence, have no relation with this mundane world. But when they desire to lord it over Maya, forgetting their real identity, the egoistic principle, Shambhu, entering into their entities, makes them identify themselves as separate enjoyers of mundane entities, like mundane entities means things, like objects. Hence, Shambhu is the primary principle of the egoistic mundane universe and of the perverted egotism in jivas that identifies itself, that's the mundane egoistic principle, identifies itself with their limited material bodies. I wanted to share this with you for a particular reason. We've got a problem. It's false ego. And even before we do something, we've got false ego, and then what to speak when we start doing something. It gets aggravated, enlarged, it's exacerbated. The problem gets worse. And it isn't a solution to do nothing either. As we do something and do nothing, we're entangled in the false egoistic principle or mundane egoistic principle. Now here's another, it's like a double whammy, a double bind. When that glance of Mahavishnu carried by Shambhu contacts the undifferentiated sum total of the material elements, as I mentioned, the time, energy, and the living entities contacting it, it becomes agitated. And then the elements start to separate out. And the first one that separates out is the most subtle, false ego. And then, this is now the Vedic description, the false ego in contact with the modes of nature makes further unfolding or differentiating of elements. False ego in contact with the mode of goodness manifests the mind. False ego in contact with passion manifests material intelligence. False ego in contact with ignorance manifests the rest. Really busy. Five material elements, earth, water, fire, air, ether, which then manifest the five knowledge-acquiring senses, the objects of the senses, the working senses. So we have a whole set of things that manifest from false ego. Point being, false ego is absolutely essential to have material life. And the converse is, if you want to become free from material life, you have to dissolve false ego. There isn't a choice. And to dissolve false ego, you need a good solvent. You need that which directly connects the soul to the Supreme, because false ego covers the soul into forgetfulness of who they really are and who the Supreme is. And as it says at the bottom here, perverted egotism in jivas helps them identify themselves with their limited material bodies. So that's who I think I am. If I'm covered with false ego, I think I'm this body. And I've got this type or that type, born in this country or that country, etc., etc. I'm a tall one, I'm a short one, a fat one, a skinny one, a pink one, a green one, a blue one, a black one, an orange one. We think in terms of the body. But it doesn't stop there. Since I want to enjoy independently of the Supreme, then I want to enjoy what's produced of this body. And I call what's produced of this body mine. I and mine. Which relates to the question, how do I distinguish my needs from my wants? You know, so what's mine? And the goal is to attain a stage where the Sanskrit phrase is nirmama, nothing is mine. In that stage where nothing is mine is everything belongs to the source of emanation, Krishna. And if everything belongs to Krishna, then what I do is use things that belong to Krishna in service to Krishna. It's a nice way of life. It's called the life of devotion to Krishna. Everything belongs to Krishna and we use things in his service. But as long as we're covered, then that illumined state or enlightened state is restricted by the covering. And it starts with false ego and then it gets layers upon layers upon layers of other more gross forms of matter. But false ego is a material element. It's a subtle material element, but it covers the living entity. And the process of spiritual life, is, as I like this image, it's to go beyond that covering and into the realm of transcendental knowledge. So now back to the question. As long as I have this body, each of us have one, and the body has certain needs. We have to put some fuel in it. We have to eat. And we have to give it some rest. We have to sleep. And when it gets cold out, generally at least, we put something warm on because it's cold out. If we protect the body from the elements and other things, protection or defending the body is another, just a natural need. And embodied souls do those things. Eat, sleep, defend, and mating is another really very important one to keep the process going. And it's not just in the human form of life, it's, you know, spiders and giraffes and fish and microbes and, you know, the process of reproduction is built into the system. It's a bodily function as long as one has a body. So the idea of spiritual life is to regulate those things and gradually diminish those things. So now the question, how do I know what I need? And so a lot of the sense of what I want has a lot to do with the particular type of false ego I have. I may think I need such and such, and another person doesn't need such and such, but they feel they need another something. And a certain amount of it in order to be happy. So we're managing in spiritual life, we're kind of negotiating a little bit or managing our false ego to help us in a state of balance reach the state of no more false ego or true ego, or where that light that you see coming out of the shell of the egg, the shell of the egg is gone, it is just light. I meant to add one more image that I don't have to show you. Whereas the illumination is just completely separated from the covering. We can, and transcendentalists function that way. They function where they tend to the needs of the body and the mind in such a way that one can sustain life. As Prabhupada's phrase is, keep body and soul together. And gradually, so until we're at the stage of enlightenment or just maintaining body and soul together, we have a whole other set of ideas of what our needs are. And so we need the answer that I gave, a short response to when this question was raised yesterday. We need to make a position that's sustainable. Let's say, how much should I eat? Or how much should I sleep? Or how many sets of clothes do I need? Or, I mean, sometimes visit people's homes and they got a zillion pairs of shoes and they only have 2 feet. But somehow they feel they need more pairs of shoes than the left one and the right one. And, you know, for different occasions, different types of shoes. You know what I mean? Fashion and so on. So, for those who wish to progress spiritually, the effort is, if you don't need it, do without it. So keep life simple. Simplicity is a quality of goodness. But there's a certain amount of what I think I need in order to be peaceful and continue on nicely with my devotional service and my practices and, you know, being a kind and gentle person, because if I don't have my needs, I'll get grumpy and I'll snap at people and, you know, bark at people and not, you know, won't be nice. So there's certain needs so I can go on peacefully. With that model in mind, then the value is not what you have. The value is the peaceful condition under which you can carry out your devotional service and devotional practices. As they become stronger and stronger, there's this nice phrase, inversely proportionate. As spiritual well-being increases, that sense that I have of necessity decreases. Material affinity decreases. And the opposite is also true. As my spiritual well-being becomes slackened, my sense of necessities of things increases. My implication in matter becomes stronger. So we wish to leverage spiritual practices and diminish the worldly involvement things. And to the extent that we have worldly involvements, it's simply to maintain a semblance of taking care of necessities. There's a nice description several places in Chaitanya Charitamrita where it's speaking about Lord Chaitanya and his life in Jagannath Puri. When he was experiencing and externally exhibiting symptoms of the highest stages of love of God. And it is said that he would do his daily activities, bathing and eating and those things, as routine. It wasn't, you know, what's for lunch. It was his thoughts were absorbed in the personality of Godhead. So he did his bathing and did his external things as a matter of duty or as a routine, but his consciousness was absorbed in transcendence. Now, I wanted to do two other things in this evening. We'll go down a little bit and say, because I've been speaking a little bit more primarily about the senses and the sense that we have of, I need some objects, I need some possessions, I need a certain amount of wealth. I was in Hyderabad during this time that I was in India, and one of the questions that came up was, how important is it that I have savings? He's a young man, not married, and he asked it with a kind of like enthusiasm or energy, and I got a sense that he was attached to accumulating wealth, thinking that it's important, because who knows what's going to happen, some calamity could come and I need some, you know, some cushion in case there's a problem. So the answer that I gave didn't satisfy him, because he wanted the answer that he wanted to hear, not the answer that was good for him to hear. What is secure in this world? Is there anything that you can say, I've got it in my hand and it won't go away? Anything. There isn't anything like that. It's all temporary. In that sense, it's illusory. The happiness or the security of whatever it is that you have. Plus, I explained, whatever it is that you have, it's never going to be enough. You're always going to think, it's got to be more, it's got to be more, it's got to be. It's just the nature of passion. It's the nature of acquisition and proprietorship. And then a slight turn of the kaleidoscope and the whole picture changes and it's calamity again. So really you're dependent upon not how much money you have saved, but you're dependent upon the will of Krishna. So you have some savings and you use balance, discretionary funds, you use that in service to the personality of Godhead and his devotees, seeing that Krishna will take care of you. That's the life of a devotee. And, you know, the look in his face was, he wasn't satisfied. And so I answered again and answered it again, and he still wasn't, because there's a nice young man, not like a grossly materialistic person, but having a sense, he had a sense that material well-being is necessary before I can do my spiritual practice nicely. And it's the other way around. Material well-being follows spiritual well-being, like a shadow follows the object that casts the shadow. You follow? Here's a nice chandelier. And here's my hand. And there's a shadow on the floor. As I move my hand, the shadow moves. If my business is to try to move the shadow without moving the hand, it's a fool's errand. You move the hand and then the shadow moves. Similarly, from spiritual well-being, material well-being follows. Those who are progressive in their spiritual lives understand that principle, so their primary attention goes to spiritual well-being. And whatever is necessary in the material well-being, that will follow. So, and what it is that I think I need in the material well-being side of things depends upon my spiritual well-being. If I neglect my spiritual well-being, then my necessities are going to increase. my sense of necessity is going to increase. And then comes this, then the question that this dialogue invokes or invites is, what are those things that I need so that I can peacefully do those activities of spiritual life, so I can progress in spiritual life nicely, and as I progress in spiritual life nicely, my needs will diminish, and I'll be satisfied. I remember visiting in Seattle. The devotee, I won't mention his name, but he won't mind my using his example. He was a gold medalist for all of Microsoft in the world. He was a super guy in the Microsoft company. And when I found that out about him, I guessed he's probably got a little red sports car. Because I've been to homes of young students, because when they're away at school and sometimes stay in their room, on this wall is a picture of a red sports car. On this wall is a picture of their favorite athlete. And on that wall is their famous movie star. But, it's like, want to get a little red sports car. And sure enough, he had a little red sports car. And he was like uncomfortable, it was so little. But it was like, zoom, zoom, and flashy, and, one of those that sounds like it needs a muffler, if it's how they make them that way, really loud. And I just sat in his car because he wanted to take me somewhere, and I laughed. I said, why'd you get this car? Well, I've always dreamed to get a little red sports car. He doesn't have it anymore. It's just like his desire for having a little red sports car, as he started practicing Krishna consciousness, he still was doing very, very well in Microsoft, but the material desire just faded. And he got so good at Microsoft, he didn't have any time for himself. They kept jacking him up and more and more and more and more. And finally he said, I want to come back down here. And they said, no, you got to stay up here. So he quit and took a simple job so he could have discretionary time. He still, has more money than he needs. So he's not in poverty by any means. But his simplicity in his life has followed behind his spiritual well-being, is my point. Just using him as an example. And there's so many examples. So where the entry point is, it's not a rule. It's, let me see what I need in order to practice spiritual life peacefully. Let me focus as much as I can on my spiritual practices, and then the necessities, they're no longer the same that they were before. They just diminish and fade progressively. Then I wanted to share another thing. This is does the name Viktor Frankl mean anything to any of you? Viktor Frankl? No? Huh? Yes. Viktor Frankl. Here's his he's the author of a book called Man's Search for Meaning. He was in a Nazi concentration camp, a Jewish psychologist. The book was written in 1946. It's been reprinted about 25 times because it sells a lot, because it says a lot, and besides that, it's really small. It's really easy to read. And while he was in the Nazi concentration camp, he was asking the question somebody naturally asks when in that situation, why is this happening? And, he was a religious man, so Why is God putting me in this circumstance? But he wasn't like whining, complaining, that kind of thing. It was, he was searching for a meaning in a situation that's as extreme as you can get. I mean, any situation that we're in that's difficult is nothing compared to that. And I'm just going to present one of the quotes that he writes in this book. What a man actually needs is not a tensionless state, but rather the striving and struggling for some goal worthy of him. What he needs is not the discharge of tension at any cost, but the call of a potential meaning waiting to be fulfilled by him. You know, a Christian term is calling. And God is, you have a calling of serving God. And his particular calling, or his meaning, waiting to be fulfilled, was, as a psychologist, he was fixed in, God is having me go through this situation so that when I'm the other side of this situation, I'll be able to help people who are undergoing stress in their life and give them the strength to undergo that situation by having a higher purpose to fulfill in life. Now, our higher purpose in devotion to Krishna is devotion to Krishna. And when we connect with devotion to Krishna, that's a life of a devotee, then the dualities of material existence, it's sometimes like this and sometimes like that. Sometimes honor, sometimes dishonor. Sometimes it's very hot, sometimes it's very cold. Sometimes this side of duality, sometimes that side of duality. And how do you deal with it? If your purpose is high and you're fixed on that, then you can pass through the dualities much more easily. That the particular example that he gives at one point in the book was they had a daily routine that the soldiers would come and jiggle their keys loud, and then they would rattle the chains on the doors outside of the metal, whatever, you know, cell that the people were in. And then they would unlock one of those. And then they would take the person that was inside and drag them off to the gas chamber and gas them to death. And as the persons were being carried away, they would scream. And then they'd be gassed and they're dead. And then the next day, jiggle the chains. So their people were just terrorized every day. They didn't know if it was them or the guy next to them or their friend or their relative or whoever it was, because they couldn't see. They just like heard the screams. Could you imagine? So one day, the lock on his door opened and the door swung open and the soldier grabbed him and was dragging him off to the gas chamber. And he describes, he just stayed fixed in his potential meaning waiting to be fulfilled, which was, on the other side of this experience, I want to be able to help people. My calling is to help people overcome trauma or difficulty or danger or some sense of stress in their life, what to speak of what he was undergoing. And what happened was, there was some noise off in some place and some disturbance, and the soldier had to leave him and go take care of the problem. And by the time he was done taking care of the problem, it was too late, so he took him back and put him in, you know, locked up the gate. He took it that, you know, Providence or God intervened because he had a higher purpose. And he, while he was being carried away, he wasn't screaming and carrying on like that. He was fixed in his potential meaning of his life, the purpose of his life, waiting to be fulfilled. So that's from the Vedic picture. This is values are something that we carry within our intelligence. It's a value that we hold, and the values that govern our lives govern all kinds of things. They govern our feelings. They govern what we do. We govern where we go, what we say, how we conduct our lives. And spiritual value, because other values are temporary, spiritual value is something that's not temporary. So the application of this, at least for me, is a goal that's worthy. That's exactly his language. Striving and struggling for some goal that's worthy. And that goal that's worthy is something that's enduring. It's eternal. It's not, now you see it, now you don't. Like something that you have in your hand and then it's gone out of your hand. It's the real purpose of life, the soul connecting with the Supreme, the mission of human life. So I added this slide here. I call this alignment, where the things that we do with our body, our mind, and our heart, and then the internal part is the soul. If we align ourselves with physical well-being, engage our minds in uplifting rather than contaminating things, our heart, the where we feel about others and the values of life that we hold, and try to keep them in proper orientation and alignment with the real interest of the soul. And you notice over here there's a key, and the key is on the inside, not on the outside. And the idea is, by practicing devotion, where we're trying to keep the needs in the category of needs and not in the categories of things that we just want that we really don't need, so we can peacefully carry out our devotional service, bring our mind to uplifting subject matters like the sound of Krishna's holy name and the message of the scripture and associating with saintly people, and feelings from within, orienting our heart in that way, it opens this door. And when that door, through the connecting with the process of devotional service, is done nicely, gradually what we see inside, the center, instead of being ourselves, becomes Krishna, becomes the center. And when Krishna is the center, false ego is dissolved, because false ego tells us that we're the center. And when false ego is dissolved, we're not the center. We never were the center. It just appears to us, you know, each one of us is thinking, there's so many little centers in the room. Me, 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 however many there are here. But the spiritual conception is Krishna is the center. And we all share the same center. Krishna is the center. And service to Krishna is our life. And we serve Krishna together. And then there becomes harmony rather than party spirit. There is an ocean of transcendental wisdom, literature, that can guide us in involving ourselves in these ways of life and these understandings. Volumes and volumes to read and absorb ourselves in, and along with the transcendental wisdom, the chanting of Krishna's holy name. So whenever you come to visit us here at the temple, of course there's lots of kirtan, lots of chanting of Hare Krishna mantra, and there's teachings that side by side with that which purifies the heart and enlivens the soul, that which can guide our activities so we can navigate our way through the field of the material energy, so that on the other side, approaching Krishna with clarity and with a purified heart becomes a very natural function in life. So as Radha Raman said, those of you that are here for the first time, please visit regularly. And there are, of course, many people here that do visit regularly. And take advantage while you're here and take the same activities to your home, the chanting of the Hare Krishna mantra in your home, as we, of course, Sankirtan is very nice here in the temple with very wonderful kirtan singers. But in your own home, even in a simple way, it's the expression of devotion that's especially nice and pleasing to Krishna and therefore also pleasing to the heart. And involve yourselves regularly in reading the literature that our founder Acharya very magnanimously provided to guide your life. Read them carefully and you'll understand what a great treasure they are, what a gift, wonderful gift has been given to you. Please take advantage like that. And look forward to seeing you again and again coming to the temple. Hare Krishna. Srila Prabhupada ki jai.